You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Editor-in-Chief Rob Weinert-Kent, and I'm here with...
Deep Tran, Associate Editor.
And we have a great show for you today. We're going to talk a little bit about arts funding, and then we're going to talk to an artist. We'll be first speaking with Lori Baskin from TCG about the state of the NEA. And then our guest is Orville Mendoza, who's now starring in Classic Stage Company's production of Pacific Overtures. And he and I have a long history on either side of the aisle. I've seen him in Pacific Overtures at least twice. And you can hear about that later. It's a fascinating conversation. I think we're going to jump right into our first section, which is with Lori, who works with us at TCG. We've talked about the NEA on a few occasions on this podcast. I interviewed Greg Reiner one time, and then we just, as we often do, just chatted about the headlines of the day. But I realized we should probably bring in someone who knows about this makes it part of your job, your life's work, really, to do arts advocacy. Lori, welcome to Offscript. Tell us your title here.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to join you. It's my first time with you. I'm Director of Research, Policy, and Collective Action here at TCG.
Right. And among the many areas that you are your specialty is arts advocacy and arts funding. And you, a couple months ago, went to Arts Advocacy Day in DC. And that was at a particularly fraught time for the state of possible arts funding at that point. What was the status when you went to DC, and then tell me a little bit about the outcome of that.
Right. Well, Arts Advocacy Day is spearheaded by our sister organization, Americans for the Arts, but TCG has long been a national co-sponsor, so we've participated for many years, and we tend to bring a delegation of board members and trustees from our National Council for the American Theater, and we set up hill visits with their elected officials. So Arts Advocacy Day was in March, and at that time, the FY17 budget for the NEA, and well, for the federal government, mm-hmm. had not been resolved. So we were simultaneously advocating for the FY17 appropriation as well as the FY18 appropriation, both at the same time. And of course, further complicating it, at that time, I believe the president had already proposed total elimination of the NEA and other cultural agencies right. for FY18 and had proposed a mid-year cut for FY17.
Okay.
So it was challenging.
And to clarify, FY17 ends in September.
Right. The federal fiscal year begins October 1 and ends September 30. So having a meeting and talking about a mid-year cut in March or April means they've gone through half the federal fiscal year and then want to do a cut. That means that any entity that has applied for funding and their application hasn't been reviewed yet or funded yet means they are going to receive a disproportionate cut if they come up later in the year. So it was tough.
So there was advocacy on two fronts there. We got out of the woods with FY17. Is that correct? I mean, how did it work out?
Well, we learned, I believe it was May 1st, that the House Appropriations Committee was recommending not only level funding, but a $2 million increase
wow.
for the NEA for FY17.
Right.
So
okay.
we came through for much of the year, the federal government was operating on what they call a continuing resolution,
yes.
which means that, and sometimes people call it a CR, but
right.
it's a continuing resolution, which means that the federal government keeps its doors open. It keeps operating all federal agencies at the previous year's funding level.
Right.
So the agency was at $148 million, and they'd been going along hoping that, you know, that the budget would eventually be approved probably at level funding. Then, of course, there was the proposal from the president for a $15 million mid-year cut. And then we learned the House. Now, of course, remember, both the House and the Senate are led by Republicans.
Yeah.
There's Republican control of both houses. So the chairman of the subcommittee and the full committee had recommended a $2 million increase for the agency. So we were kind of having a momentary celebration in a time when we've seen a lot of challenge.
Wow.
I feel like this is probably a really stupid question, but I'm really curious now. So from what I understand of the NEA, they announce their grants at the beginning of the fiscal year of which theater companies around the country will be receiving NEA grants. Is that?
No, not at the beginning of the fiscal year. They have several rounds of reviews applications come up.
Right. So like they fund it. So funding is given within like a quarterly,
twice a year is mm-hmm. primarily when theater companies would see grants. I think there's usually a round announced in December and then again later in the spring. So at least twice, and it depends on which programs a theater company may have applied to. And there are other places one could apply to, the arts education program or for research or other areas.
Right. But if you applied for money, that, like, what happens if you applied for money and then you think you're going to get a grant and then they decide to cut the funding or like have a budget cut in the middle of the year?
Right. So actually, to be totally transparent here, TCG receives a grant usually annually from the NEA, and our grant announcement was supposed to happen in this second round. And we received a notification saying that while they were ready to tell us what our grant would be, it was put on hold until the FY17 budget was resolved.
I see.
And then they would get back to us and let us know, because they couldn't spend the money until they knew from Congress what was going to happen. So that first week in May, the House, you know, put its level out there. The Senate approved it, mm-hmm. and they came up with their budget. You know, House and Senate usually come up with their own budgets. Then they have to reconcile them between the two houses. Then it goes to the president for his signature. And I have to say, you know, I was away on business on that Friday, I think it was May 5th, mm-hmm. wondering, is the president going to sign the budget? And indeed he did. So we came through FY17 okay.
Great. But I, yeah.
Oh, did we get more money, Laurie? At TCG?
TCG? I think we got what we thought we were going to get.
Right.
Yeah.
We didn't get a massive increase. I have two questions about the... So this is good news.
Yes.
That the House and the Senate recommended an increase. And I wanted to ask a little bit about the politics of that. I think we assume that this is a partisan issue. But I think what I've learned from talking to you and others is that this doesn't cut along party lines really easily, that there's a lot of Republicans who are pro-arts funding and some Democrats who are lukewarm. It's not easy, like, obviously this is going to be a problem. So that's the first question. The second part is, does this bode well for the future? Can you speak about those two things?
So in answer to the first part, arts advocates, both people who spend their lives doing it like I do and other colleagues at other national art service organizations, as well as people in our field, we have long worked very hard to be bipartisan in our work. So I think that we've done a good job over the years of telling various elected officials that, you know, theater XYZ in whatever town across the country, that we have, you know, they have done good work in serving their community, however many students are served, how many subscribers and audience members, and that they provide really a civic duty.
Right.
And like a town hall function where ideas are exchanged and people learn about each other, you know, by going to the theater. So I think that elected officials have heard a lot of good stories over the years, and there has been a great deal of bipartisan support for the arts and for the NEA and other cultural agencies. You know, there's probably more support consistently from Democrats than Republicans. But I would also share that there are other issues that we advocate on, and for instance, preserving charitable incentives for giving, tax giving. And oftentimes Republicans are more supportive of that issue. So we work hard on all of our issues to make sure that elected officials know that we value their support on both sides of the aisle. In terms of how this bodes for the future, I think it was a very good signal that they not only held the line but gave a little increase to the NEA in a year when there were threats to that funding. So I think that, you know, again, we've done a good job and we have bipartisan support. We go into FY18 with the president proposing total elimination of the NEA, and that would be devastating. The NEA leverages private money. It supports theaters in urban areas, but also rural and suburban areas, areas where it's harder to find private funding. And they count on that NEA funding. NEA grants go to every congressional district in the country. So people really depend on those grants to fund things that private sector entities might not fund. And so we're challenged going in with a proposal of zero from the executive branch. But again, I think it's hopeful that we have bipartisan support on both sides, you know, both in the House and the Senate and both sides of the aisle. But that does not mean we can rest on our laurels. And I don't know if you were going to ask this Rob.
My next question is, what can we do now? What would be the appropriate stance or attitude of action and steps we could take going forward?
Everybody is going to have to participate. These are those moments when we need to see thousands and thousands of messages going to Capitol Hill at moments when NEA funding will be considered, and all of our issues. But for the moment, we're focusing on NEA for this conversation. So both the House and the Senate are currently working on budget resolutions, which set sort of budget levels for various committees that govern kind of how things go for the year. It's just a recommendation. The actual appropriations process, the House and Senate Interior Appropriations Subcommittees are the first step in setting funding levels. You know, the president can propose a zero and Congress still says, but we do the budget.
Yeah.
So our work is focused on the Hill.
Right.
So if you're a member of Congress, sits on an appropriations subcommittee, the Interior Committee that funds the NEA, they're the ones that sort of, they start with the dollar amount. That's where the negotiations start. Then it goes to the full appropriations committee. And then ultimately, if things follow normal process, to the House floor and the Senate floor for votes on appropriations bills. So the committee process would largely happen in May and June. And then conference committee to resolve the differences between the two bills would probably happen later in the summer. And then into the fall, they would come together and send to the bill, hopefully for his signature by September 30th, since the new fiscal year begins October 1. But it really means that at each juncture, and TCG sends out action alerts.
Okay.
When those moments are happening in subcommittee or full committee, or there's we might learn there's going to be a vote or something introduced on the House floor to cut the NEA or an amendment introduced by somebody. Then we'll want to rally the troops to oppose, vote no on that amendment. Issue advocacy is allowed. We encourage our member theaters, people who love theater, individual artists, audience members, anybody who's involved in this realm, we encourage active participation at those moments. So if you're at a TCG member theater, you work there, or you're a trustee, you should be receiving action alerts, and it takes 2 minutes. You receive an alert. It's an email in your inbox. There's a way to click through to take action.
Okay.
There's already a message that I've drafted, a message to your elected official. You don't have to look up who that is. And you could personalize it and say what your role in the theater is, or that you're a theater lover. And then you send it to your elected official. hopefully people are doing that 3, 4, 5 times this year.
Right.
And telling all their friends, because this is so important to participate.
And the form that would take would includes this form that you filled out, but they could also call their congressperson.
Yeah, they could call. I will say that because of the climate we're in now, I do hear stories about elected officials not so much always answering. They don't answer the phone themselves, but that their staffers are allowing calls to go through to sort of this voicemail system where you can register whatever it is you're calling about.
Or it's full, or it's busy,
or you can't get through. So, you know, if you really want to get something off your chest and you want to call, I say call. But the email is almost easier. We've tried to make it as easy as possible for folks, and they count them. They count the messages they get.
Right.
And so that's really an important thing to do.
That sounds good.
In your experience, Lori, doing issue advocacy, like what have been strategies that you've used to like convince or open the minds of Congress people who might not be on the side that we're fighting for?
Sure. This year, in preparation for Arts Advocacy Day, we every year prepare what we call an issue brief on each of the issues. The National Endowment for the Arts issue brief, we're asking for $155 million. So that would be a $5 million increase over the current level for FY17, which is bold in this environment. But there are three buckets of talking points. One is that NEA funding provides a high return on investment. Generally speaking, each public dollar generates $9 more in additional funding from other sources. So that's one bucket, the high return on investment. And we think in this climate, and Republicans, particularly since they're in leadership now and they control, you know, the agenda, that that would be persuasive for them. The second bucket of talking points is that NEA funding supports partnerships that advance the arts and communities. The NEA is funding a program called Creative Forces, I believe it's called, but it supports military families and veterans and active duty military that are suffering from PTSD and so forth. And they've got a wonderful program called, I think it's called Creative Healing or Creative Forces.
Okay.
And it's persuasive, honestly, on the Hill. The other bucket of talking points that we use and arguments to support NEA funding is that NEA funding broadens access to all. Some people think that NEA funding or arts funding in general, it's this elitist activity. And in fact, it's the opposite.
Right.
It's public funding that allows arts organizations to be able to open their doors to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford or access the arts, either because of geography or other reasons, including economic. So it's a leveling force, and we think that that's important. And I think that NEA funding and theater in particular promotes empathy between people, and there's nothing more important right now.
Right.
So those are kind of a summary of the kinds of arguments and talking points we use. The issue brief, as well as action alerts, are all posted on the TCG website, tcg.org.
Okay.
On the top navigation bar, there's a click for advocacy, and the action alerts are under there, as well as the various issue areas, the NEA and the issue brief there.
Right. Well, and we'll also have links to that page on the TCG website on the post for this podcast.
Great.
Yeah, I think you already answered this. I can see why you have the job you have. You already answered a question. I was going to ask about what one of the major misconceptions, if you could tell people one misconception they might have about the NEA, and I think that is the elitist one, is the idea that it goes to institutions that already are secure and are for rich white people. And,
there's
a grain of truth in it, it's not just the NEA, but in terms of where arts funding goes in general, there's been lots of studies about philanthropy, but it's also true that states' arts councils are all of them get money from the NEA. Is that correct? So there's a decentralizing that happens with the funding.
There's a federal-state partnership
exactly.
in that 40% of the NEA's grant funds have to be distributed through state arts councils.
Right.
They do have to apply for it. They, you know, state arts councils don't just get it. They do have to apply, and they do have to sort of meet certain requirements as well, like any other grantee. So there have been cases over the years. I mean, if the state doesn't have a state arts council, or they don't meet certain requirements, I think there have been a couple of occasions where that hasn't happened. But by and large, every state, I believe, receives some form of NEA funding through the State Arts Council, as well as direct grants to arts organizations. So that's the 60% of funding. So, there's the elitist argument that I think there's, criticism. I think some people think that all the money goes to, like, New York and California. That's not true either. No. You can see on the website, and the NEA is very transparent about where their grants go. And you can, they have an amazing search function. You can search by state or for a particular theater, and you can look up what the grants are or have been over the years. But no, it's distributed. Like I say, there are grants going to every single congressional district across the country.
Right.
Because I remember that David Marcus conversation on NPR where he argued against NEA funding and for the elimination of the NEA, saying it private sector funding encourages more competition.
Yeah,
so that people can make better art.
And it was a marketplace sort of argument, and we sent a letter back that I believe we've posted online as well.
Yeah, we did. It was on AmericanTheater.org. Mm-hmm. Teresa wrote, I think it was pretty thorough.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Throw a takedown of that. I mean, it sounds to me like one of the convincing, the first bucket, economic impact, has been very persuasive. And I, you know, anecdotally and just commonsensically, it seems like that has been persuasive with folks on both sides of the aisle, both parties.
Absolutely.
And that the idea that it's had local impact and
rural impact too, because there's no money to be found in rural areas.
Exactly.
And so that's why you would need that kind of funding. Yeah.
And part of the economic impact also is that people need to be reminded that we have real jobs. I mean, like, you know, they talk about wanting to stimulate, you know, jobs and create more jobs in the United States. And, you know, everybody who works in the theater, we actually have real jobs.
Yeah,
they're
these
not
are jobs.
Fake.
Yes.
You know, like we pay mortgage or we pay rent and, you know, we put food on the table.
Right.
And
we have kids go to school.
That's right. Yeah, and like, so we're part of the economy as well. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I think Art Works was one of the slogans. Do they still have that slogan?
That's one of the funding categories.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Yes.
But I always thought it was a great slogan. It was Art Works. These are art workers. And that it works for people. It's work as well as art.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, but there is this perception within American popular culture that if you're doing what you love, then you can't possibly be working, so it's not a legitimate profession.
Sure.
Right. But it's real jobs, and theaters create a real economic impact in their communities. I mean, when you think about it, they're buying, you know, lumber from the lumber yards.
Right.
How many restaurants always sprout up near theater companies?
Right, right, right.
They're using the dry cleaner for the costumes, et cetera, et cetera. So they're making a real impact economically beyond the impact on, you know, the work that they're presenting and the conversations that they're stimulating in their communities.
You don't have to go very far to find people who have been touched by theater at some point in their life, whether performing in it or their families in it, or, you know, we're talking about theater specifically. It's the arts in general, but
all the arts get funding from the NEA.
That is true.
That's
it's
right.
called the
That's
National
right.
Endowment for the Arts. Not National,
all the
National
arts.
Endowment for the Theater. Which,
That's right.
We wish.
No,
we
had our own fund, but no.
No, and I love actually when we come across those kinds of stories about elected officials. You know, that their wife is a playwright, or their daughter takes dance classes, or whatever, and you find out those kinds of stories, and you get to know the elected official or their staffer and find out, they took theater in college and they love theater. And, you know, so that you find those personal connections and you try to cultivate those relationships too.
Totally.
Well, right. It's all part of like when you're trying to call your congresspeople and trying to advocate for an issue, like you're telling personal stories. It's not a concept.
It's all about personal stories. It's all about if you get an NEA grant, and any theater that's receiving an NEA grant should definitely be advocating for the value and the impact of those dollars in the community and telling the story of what they were able to do with those dollars, mm-hmm. who they were serving and the impact that, that the grant made in the community. Yeah. So there's, it's all about storytelling, and that's what we do in theater.
Great. Well, Lori, it's been a pleasure to hear you talk about this, and I hope our listeners, will act on it. It sounds like it's a hope, cautiously hopeful, but not rest on our laurels and kick back at this point.
I think that's how we're feeling.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good. Well, that's better than I thought we might be, frankly. At least in this realm of public life.
Yeah, the rare hopeful news.
Yeah,
well, exactly. I think it's about doing the work and paying attention to Congress because, mm-hmm. you know, certainly the executive branch has not been our friend on this issue.
Right.
But I think that with bipartisan support and if we and the field, if we do the work, there's hope. Yes.
Good. We'll take it.
Yeah.
So I just want to prepare for our interview with Orville Mendoza. I realized I had such a fun time talking to Orville about a show we both know well, Pacific Overtures, that we didn't really set up the show. So I'll just spend one moment explaining that Pacific Overtures is a musical from 1976 by Stephen Sondheim and John Wideman. It's about the opening, quote unquote, of Japan, 1850s Japan, which had been shut off for centuries from the outside world. And the U.S. Sent warships and opened it.
Forcibly opened it,
and then it opened up to the Western world, and then you know, it tells the story of both internecine battles in Japan over Westernization, and then the decision to become a very Western nation by the end. So that's the backdrop. Orville, you know, I saw him act a lot in L.A., and we talk a lot about those days. He mentions Tim Dang. I don't think we've talked about this. East-West Players, former artistic director. Hopefully you'll understand in context all that we talk about and enjoy the interview with Orville. Here with Orville Mendoza. Thanks for coming in, Orville. This is a meeting like years overdue because I've been following your work, you know, even without knowing it, since Los Angeles East West Players.
Yeah, you were with Drama Lot?
No,
still?
No. It was Backstage West.
Yeah,
and I think I've mentioned this. You were the first Sweeney Todd I saw on stage. Of course, everyone saw the video, right?
Yeah.
With George Hearn, but you were the first one I saw live in a great production. I think that was 94.
Yeah, wow.
East West Players.
24-year-old Asian sweetie.
you were great. Deb Nishimura as a
Beggar Mrs. Woman.
She wasn't Mrs. Lovett. Who was Mrs. Lovett?
Mrs. Lovett was Frida Fauchin.
Okay, all right, okay.
Yeah.
My memory is going, I guess. Deb Nishimura was the Beggar Woman. That was great. And then, of course, one of the definitive experiences of my theater-going life really was when East West Players opened their new space in Little Tokyo, mm-hmm. and Pacific Overtures. I think that's the first time they staged it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, actually Mako had staged it back in the 80s, like right.
Oh, okay.
Kind of when East West was founded. So he had just kind of finished the run on Broadway and then,
and they did one at East West. Okay.
Yeah. Co-founded East West. And then they did a small version of Pacific Overtures then.
And we're bringing you in now, I mean, for a variety of reasons, but you're doing Pacific Overtures again.
Yeah.
Now at Classic Stage Company through June 18th. It's been extended.
Yes.
Quite a bit. It's a wonderful production, quite different.
Very different.
And you switched roles. Before you were Kayama.
Yeah.
And now you are Manjiro. Is
yes,
that correct?
Manjiro.
Manjiro.
Yeah. You know, based on a historical character, actually, I mean, historical person.
Right.
John Manjiro. In fact, I think there is a John Manjiro Friendship Society in Massachusetts.
Oh, really?
Yes. Because, you know, he was the first Japanese person to live in America. And so, you know, the facts of John Manjiro being rescued from a fishing boat is all true.
Right.
He was rescued. He and I think his brother and two other friends were taken to Hawaii. His brother and friends decided to come back to Japan, but he decided to stay on the boat with the captain, who took him to Massachusetts, where he settled, I think for like 10 years. He studied here.
Right.
Became a maritime person. Like, he learned, you know, all of that. And then he actually came back to Japan and became a translator and is very revered in Nakahama, where okay. he is from.
So he didn't become a militant.
No, that is a little bit of a creative yeah. license, yeah. you know, taken with John Weidman and Pacific Overtures.
It's such a beautiful path, though. I mean, I wonder if you talk about in Kayama, you have the reverse path of yeah. someone who becomes Western and loses a lot in as much as he gains, at least in the process, and then the reverse for Montreux.
Absolutely,
you talk about the reversal
you know,
there.
It's so. Especially with this staging, you know, being, it's so intimate and really now focusing on the relationship between Kayama and Manjiro. There's a lot about Manjiro that I relate with, having been born in the Philippines,
yeah.
in Manila, and then my family coming here when I was 2 years old and really feeling American.
Yeah.
It wasn't until actually I got into college that and started acting that I realized how other I was because right. I couldn't play this or I couldn't do that. And then, you know, going into myself and asking those questions is like, okay, so, you know, what are you? Who do you really identify with? So even as much as I love American and America and feel American, there is a big part of me, of course, that is Filipino and has an allegiance to the Philippines and whatever that is, whatever, you know, being Filipino is and
right.
exploring that. And I feel like Manjiro goes on that same journey.
Yeah. Okay.
So he does come to America and, you know, really is smitten and enamored by, you know, what he experiences here. But then there comes a turning point when, I feel like in the story of Pacific Overtures, it gets accelerated during Bowler Hat.
Yeah.
You know, he
yeah.
sees the potential, the possible danger of, what could happen and the loss of culture and of person when, you know, an invading ideology comes into a country.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's what makes him, get back to his roots and be more loyal to his roots.
Right, right, right. No, it's a striking production. We talked about a little bit before about how, it's mostly in modern dress.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. it's very spare. This is the John Doyle style.
Yes.
And it's cut a few, it's cut a big number and some other bits are cut
yes.
as well, right?
So, you know, John Doyle style, this is my third show with John, is Brechtian.
Yeah.
You know, and he makes no bones about it. He wants the audience to know that we are indeed actors telling the story.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, maybe some audience members could come up and actually tell the story as well.
Okay.
We just happen to be the people that are telling the story.
Right.
So he loves, you know, that convention. And also coming from, where, you know, he was artistic directors of theaters that never had a lot of money.
Yeah.
And, he made that an advantage rather than, a disadvantage by,
right.
you know, tapping into people's imaginations. And so even, you know, when he does things on Broadway or whatever, he's got it, you know, a virtually unlimited budget. He's still true to, you know, his style of storytelling, which is the audience must come 50% of the way
yeah.
with us
yeah, yeah.
in order, you know, and, so yes, in our production, we are all in modern dress and we start today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And hopefully, you know, through the opening number, we're telling the audience, okay, now we're going to go back in time mm-hmm. and tell you about this place, and how it was in Japan.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, we set that up and with very few props and, you know, swaths of fabric, you know, hopefully we're able to recreate, without literally, putting on kimono.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Things like, you know, just things that are suggestive. So, you know, again, that goes back to John's style of mm-hmm. really needing the audience and wanting the audience to come with us partway.
And you were talking about how, now, Chrysanthemum Tea, this big number, which is a funny and sort of one of his sometimes big montages where he goes through time.
Yes.
Was cut. And I think you explained that to me in a pre-interview conversation about the aesthetic choice that was sort of – it was going from ceremonial to more
yeah.
vaudeville.
Yeah. So, you know, it was important for John In the way he wanted to tell the story, for it to go from very ceremonial to slowly, slowly getting more Broadway or musical theater when the Western influence comes into Japan.
As it comes in, yeah, yeah.
And the place where Chrysanthemum Tea comes in the original production, is a great break because it's comedic. It's, you know, in Sondheim's book, Finishing the Hat, he talks about it as a Jewish mother song.
Right.
And it's very much that, you know, it's very much of that, genre. And John felt like it's just too jar. Like it's not time yet for that. Slowly we get more and more, we get closer to it with, Welcome to Kanagawa.
Yeah, right.
And then ultimately it's full blown with,
Please Hello.
Please Hello.
Yeah,
and the Admirals, coming to Japan. But, you know, it also, even, you know, John Weidman has said that was a little bit of a fiction where, you know, in Japanese history, the Shogun's mother never actually poisoned him.
Oh, sure.
So, and that, you know, that's another character that, has been, taken out of our production. But so we start the production with Lord Abe being the Shogun from the top of the show.
Okay. Yeah.
And so that eliminates that whole, you know, sequence where the previous Shogun, usually played by the reciter, gets, poisoned by his mom.
Poisoned.
And then Abe gets promoted. And then, you know, you go on with the rest of the
and
story.
And the plot point, as I recall, not to go too deep in this, is so that the Americans can come ashore.
Yes.
Which was the first Shogun is resisting.
And, absolutely.
Right.
You know, and there are some, you know, rich, storytelling colors in Chrysanthemum Tea, you know, talking about a spider on the wall.
Oh, and, my gosh.
You know, signify success, whose success I cannot guess. And then
should we do the song? I love it.
And so, you know, when Kayama makes reference to it during Bowler Hat,
it becomes more spider on the wall. Yeah. That's right. So there's call outs.
Yeah, there are call outs to that number. But, you know, I think ultimately for the way, you know, we're telling it now, it makes sense to me. And, you know, the thing with John, he never, he would rather people have strong opinions about his work.
Okay.
And definitely this is one where people have like, oh, I hate that, or they love it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, you know, he's, you know, he likes that. He never kind of wants to be, you know, middle of the road. And so this was a definite, you know, when we started rehearsal, we knew it wasn't going to be in the show from day one.
Okay.
So he'd already hashed it out with Steve Sondheim and John Weidman.
Right.
And so, you know, if they felt okay with it, then we were like, okay, we've got to be okay with it.
You were fine with that. And so you told me you'd done it a couple of – Irvine Civic Light Opera was the first time you did it?
So Irvine Civic Light Opera, way like 91. That's where I first met Tim Dang. And he was the reciter in that production. And that's where my relationship started with him. He invited me to East-West Players and – on my first show there was Into the Woods, where I was a young baker, understudy, and Cinderella's Prince and Wolf.
Right.
I mean, and, you know, that to me was, you know, when I went into this business, of course, my parents were completely upset. They're like, how are you going to make a living? You know, what are your opportunities? And I'm like, I don't know, but I think it's going to be okay.
Okay.
And then, you know, when I did that show, Tim came around and just, He talked about this production at East West Players, and I've heard of East West Players, but like never really didn't see their work at that time. And an all Asian cast doing Sondheim, doing Into the Woods. And I think, you know, for that time, it was kind of revolutionary because I can't think of another time when I've just seen an all Asian cast do anything other than an Asian show.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, like, you know, in my head is like, oh yeah, there are possibilities here. There, you know, especially in theater.
Right.
So, you know, being invited to work with East West, that training to me, like, yes, I went to Cal State San Bernardino for theater. But that on the job training, you know, mixed with mentors, people who had been in the business, like Alvin Ng and, Glenn Chin. Mm-hmm. And, Tai Ma, they all took us young kids in and just showed us, okay, this is what you can expect from the business.
Right.
And I learned professionalism. Mm-hmm. You know, I learned to not take myself so seriously.
Yeah.
Just so many things that I feel like I had such an advantage over because of East West Players.
Right. You know, what I think one thing that's striking about your career is that you've definitely done your time in roles that are intended for Asians, but you've done a lot of roles that are outside of that, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
In fact, I think I read somewhere that you, if you did the statistics, is like you, in terms of roles, you've done more that are not specified as Asian.
Absolutely. So, you know, well, even in, just in the Sondheim that I've done,
right, of course.
I was an original cast member in Roadshow,
right,
where, you know, I played everything but Asian,
right,
and I understudied Alex Gemignani in the role of Addison Meisner, which he's a workhorse, so I didn't get to go on, but Steve did tell John Doyle that if Orville ever gets a chance to go on, I'd love to come and see him because I think he's very talented.
Wow.
And so, you know, that was an amazing experience. And then I did, you know, Passion at Classic Stage,
right,
where I was Italian. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this time around, I have to be honest and say, you know, I would have been a little upset if John didn't call me to actually play an Asian when an Asian role actually, you know, that he's directing, you know, came up. So.
Right, right. No, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about it. You're someone who's one of the main Sondheim interpreters I've seen through my life. Even in New York, when I think about Sondheim interpreters, there's not a lot of consistency between casts.
Right.
I've seen basically. I shouldn't think out loud on the podcast. But in any case, you've been a through line there with Sweeney Todd, Roadshow, and then these two Pacific Overtures.
Yeah.
And only two of those. So the Pacific Overtures is the only one that was written for Asian characters. I wish I'd seen that Into the Woods. I heard about it. It's legendary. But
it was, it was a blast. I was young. Everything was possible. And, you know, again, it's
nothing made sense, right?
Nothing made sense. And I would do anything.
Right,
you know?
Right. So I wanted to ask you about, you moved to New York in 2000.
Yes, 2000.
But you were raised in
Southern California.
And then but what put you on the road was Miss Saigon.
Yeah.
Starting in 94.
So, while I was doing Sweeney Todd, I was in for my seventh audition for Miss Saigon.
Right.
And, I'd always been auditioning for the young Tui part, and then the last time I was like, you know, you're a character guy, you're half the engineer's age, but maybe you should go in for that in my brain.
Right.
So, you know, I took a calculated risk and I learned the engineer stuff and they liked it. You know, they called me back, flew me to New York back in the days when the production flew you to New York and put you up for
really?
Callbacks.
Just yeah. for callback. Wow.
Just for, you know, and it was for, you know, Cameron McIntosh and everyone.
Sure, sure.
And
was
then,
the first or second national tour?
This is the second national tour.
Okay.
And also, you know, it helped that for the second national, they wanted people that had not done the show before. So
right.
they wanted a fresh cast. And so, you know, anyway, long story short, I booked that.
Yeah.
I was on the road for the whole time from opening till they closed in Buffalo in 2000. And that's where I met my partner, Brian. And he's from New York. So I was like, guess what? I'm coming to New York with you.
So you, and then you were part of the tour or another production.
Yeah,
I've
done since the closing of that tour. I've probably done like three or four more productions of the show independently. Like I did a production at the Muni in St. Louis, and
okay.
then most recently we did a tour 3-4 years ago that went to Hartford and Detroit and the Ordway in mm-hmm. Minnesota, and you know at the Ordway the show got protested, which mm-hmm. I thought was wonderful.
Mm.
I liked that Asian voices and Asian opinions were being heard. We never wanted to shut them down.
Right.
We wanted to offer them though, the opinion to, like a lot of them had just read the script.
Right.
And you know, I feel like times have changed. They were conscious to leave the actors out of the protest, you know, because they said, well, you know, especially Asian actors need to take whatever jobs they can get,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which saddened me because, you know, I think we were at an age where like the power that we had as Asian actors and artists is that we could input an authenticity
mm-hmm.
to the proceedings, you
right.
know, that, you know, previously, probably wouldn't have been taken seriously. So my issue was that, you know, I wish they had seen the show and how we interpreted off the page.
Right.
Because if they had a problem with, you know, the engineer who I played, I'm 50% to blame.
Okay.
With that.
Yeah, yeah.
The show has, you know, really opened up it was my first production contract. And, it's, you know, given me an entree into the business like, you know, no other production has.
Yeah.
And, but having said that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is where, you know, I can get it in kind of, muddy water or whatever here. Having seen the latest revival.
Okay, sure.
There were some things I took issue with.
In the new revival.
In the new revival. Yeah. Some directorial choices I felt like were unnecessary and a little gratuitous to me. And, you know, my friends who are in the show, again, I think I'm sounding like the protesters. Like, I want to leave the actors out of this because, you know, that is, it's their creative, you know, they have to love the show and they are, you know, completely whatever, committed and brilliant in their depictions. And I'm not arguing that. I just had a problem with the overall interpretation of the new interpretation of the engineer.
Okay.
And that I felt like, you know, he's very violent now.
Right.
He, you know, to give away a little bit of a spoiler, he does actually murder someone to take their, uniform.
Right. Which is not in the original.
Right. But, and to me, his saving grace when I would play it is that he was kind of like MacGyver. He didn't need a gun to get what he needed.
Right.
And he would just use his brain and, you know, his negotiating skills to be able to work his way to, you know, wherever he needs to get. And in this production, it's just, it's so overt and just so, and just, you know, a lot of the violence in the beginning is, I feel like, you know, it's so intense in the beginning that it kind of loses, you kind of get numb to it over the course of the show.
I have not seen the new Broadway production. I saw Kevin Lee, I think, was that his name? Kevin? No, Kevin, the one who did it in LA when it came to Yamas.
So. Oh, Kevin Gray.
Kevin Gray, sorry. Yeah. Kevin Lee, Kevin Gray. And I've always thought of that character as sort of a Fagin type character, you know, a hustler. I haven't seen the new one to know how John's doing it. I wondered if you could, to broaden the lens a little bit, how would you compare? Maybe this is muddy water as well. Compare, the representation that, cause you've, as a musical theater performer, who's taken roles written for Asians, that's mostly been written by white writers, right? Whether it's, I don't know if you've done Here Lies Love, but there's Here Lies Love, there's Pacific Overtures, there's King and I, there's Flower Drum Song. I mean, there's a bunch of other titles, but they're mostly by white writers. Would you, how you would compare the way that these properties depict Asians on stage?
Sure. You know, I will say that, you know, with, Pacific Overtures, there is more nuance there.
Right.
There isn't such an in-your-face, like, Orientalism.
Okay, yeah.
The styles are so wildly different from Rodgers and Hammerstein to Claude-Michel Schoenberg and Alain Boublil to Stephen Sondheim and John Weidman to David Byrne, you know, and Alex Timbers. That is like, it's hard to compare. Well, you take on these roles, and my job as an actor is not to, well, yeah, it, you know, I do judge the piece, but I have to look at it and find what the humanity is, what the truth is in there. So whatever I'm presented with, and I'm not saying I just lie down and accept, you know, whatever is given to me.
Yeah, sure.
But if this is what's given to me and it's, you know, multi-million-dollar budget and blah, 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 I have to go, okay, what makes this person redeemable? Or what are the qualities inside me that could make me actually do this?
Right, right.
And make that human and not just a two-dimensional cutout of why the villain would do this.
Right, sure, sure.
I'm obviously talking about Miss Saigon. As far as something like Pacific Overtures, I feel like there's such humanity in every scene and in every word. So I'm not actually thinking about being Japanese. I'm thinking about just being Orville.
Right.
And how I would sincerely react if I were placed in a situation where, you know, I had to go back under penalty of death and tell my country that, you know, this is going to happen to them. So there's something a little more organic and easier. It's obviously easier to play when things are written much more richly.
Yeah, sure. Sure. When there's more nuance and it's written, what I think the point Deep has made when she saw the show, we have to make deep Deep is in the room producing. It just puts you in that world without apology.
Absolutely.
There is a cross-cultural thing going on, but it's from the Japanese point of view. Again, not by Japanese authors, but by authors who are depicting that.
I mean, and I have to say also the biggest benefit of the way we're doing the show now, you know, and several of us in the cast have done the show before. And I remember on the first day of rehearsal, you know, we're delivering lines like, yes, my lord, the ships are coming and you might, and John was like, okay, stop. Everyone take a deep breath. I want you to deliver that news like it's Orville, my friend Orville, walking into the room and telling me that these ships are coming to Japan.
Okay.
And once he said that, it was like, oh.
You took out the formality.
Yeah, we're not doing kabuki anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and John Doyle, you know, is like, I don't know what kabuki is and I'm not going to pretend I do. So we're going to find our own physicality to tell this show.
Right.
And the physicality ultimately is how you as a person would tell the story.
Right. So we had a writer pitch a story about whether we should write about the socks.
Right.
The fact that you're all not wearing
Tommy
shoes.
Socks. Yeah.
You're all wearing socks. That's Anne Hold Ward did the costumes,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Did she pick out those socks individually?
You can get them from, I think, any Taekwondo store because, you know, that's what they use.
Oh, okay. Right. So they stay on. They don't slip.
Not at all. Yes.
Nice. I was thinking back on the only other thing I'd seen you in over the years was Aladdin at California Adventure.
Yeah.
Francesco Benzambello's productions many years before it came to New York Broadway in a totally different version. And what was striking about it was I just seen you and Michael Lee.
Yes.
Is that right? As Kamayama and Majiro in Pacific Overtures. And you played Aladdin and the Genie in this production of California Adventure. And recently, it's going to close, right?
Oh, it's closed already.
It's just closed.
So Frozen is there that Liesl Tommy directed.
Wow.
And the thing I love about that is that, okay, so, you know, we started Aladdin and Francesca made a point of casting ethnic people in the leads.
Right.
And that has been carried out over. Liesl Tommy now has completely multi-ethnic cast for Frozen.
Wow.
So Ella can be black one day or is Asian one day or is Hispanic one day. And it doesn't matter.
Right.
The kids love it because it's, you know, ultimately just storytelling.
Yeah.
And, that I like that trend that they're going with these shows.
And they went with that back then. I remember going to see it and I was remembering you were blue.
Yes. Oh gosh, that makeup. It was like 2 hours every day to put that on because it was the first show that Disney for the parks wanted to do as a real like Broadway show.
Right.
So not just plopping heads onto people and custom made prosthetics for my chin, for my nose, for my head.
And it was a bald cap with the
bald cap. And it was a specially made bald cap because they tried different bald caps and they ultimately had to. Those appliances cost like $200 a pop.
Wow.
Each time. And you could only use it once.
Wow.
And of course, it's Disney though. You know, that's like one family.
Right.
coming
right,
into
right.
the park. But, you know, yeah, it was elaborate and, we started out with two makeup artists taking 2 hours to put everything on. And then you had to we did four shows a day.
Right.
And you had to get retouched because you would sweat under that. But it was a blast. And I have to say, I have a crazy funny side to me too. And the thing, the convention with that is like, you know, how can you ever top Robin Williams' interpretation?
Of course. Yeah.
So what they did is, and, also opening the show was, Nick Santa Maria, who was, the other genie. So there were two
casts.
That's right. Cause there's no way, you know, one cast could do all those shows and they never close. There's never a dark day there.
Yeah.
And so Nick Santa Maria was the other,
The other genie
who opened the show.
Yeah.
And they let us improv at certain moments, different jokes.
Okay.
And so the convention was, you know, the genie's a time traveler. He goes back and forth. And so, you know, it was when Martha Stewart was going to jail. So we added Martha Stewart jokes. Arnold Schwarzenegger was the governor. So we would, governator jokes and like, and the audience would come back to see what new jokes, you know, would, get inserted. Nick was more experimental than I was. He's more of a comedian than me.
All right, all right.
I would workshop things.
So, right. So you script your improvs a little
right.
bit.
Right, right. I would at least take, you know, 2 or 3 days to work a joke. Okay, it didn't land. Maybe if I tweak it, and then I would change it. But like Nick was like almost every show, I think he would do a different joke.
It's funny. I was thinking about it. I have seen you play very, very somber roles most yes. of the time. Is that right?
I mean, that is more akin to what I feel. I feel like I'm a more a moody person.
Soulful.
There are a lot of people that know me as a crazy character guy. My first kind of big show was in New York was Adrift in Macau.
Okay.
That Christopher Durang wrote. It was his first musical since History of Film.
Yeah, I don't know that one. But
on Broadway. But so that I played Tempura, which was – and the thing I loved about that is, yes, it was stereotypical, but it was a complete send-up and of those – of how ridiculous those films of the Charlie Chan films of the 40s, 30s and 40s were.
Right.
And okay. so he was completely conscious. You know, we were trying to show you that this is just ridiculous. And it turned out that character was actually Irish. So I had a song called I'm Actually Irish, my 11 o'clock number. So I was such a master of disguise that, you know, you thought I was Asian this whole time. No, I'm actually Irish in my, you know, I've been hiding from you and I'm actually the murderer. And so that was great fun to play.
That's funny. I realized that I in reviews I wrote of you, for both Pacific Overtures and Sweeney Todd, I referred to your jack-o'-lantern face. I feel bad that I said it both times. So,
but I guess I completely own it and I love it. Yes. My mom looks at my head and I'm like, she's like, how did you come out of me? Cause I think my head was always this large from birth.
Oh man. Orville, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. After all these years, I hope to see more of your work.
Definitely.
In all different kinds of shows.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And like, you know, our 20 plus year history.
I know. Across the aisle. We never really sat down to talk. So it's really the summit. I'm glad it happened.
My pleasure. All right, anytime. Man.
And we're back. I hope that was clear, our conversation. We were very enthusiastic. We should have kept the mics on, though, because after we spoke to Orville, we kept speaking more about Miss Saigon and Asian representation. It was a wonderful conversation. It could have been a series, but thanks for coming in, Orville. Let's see. We have some recommendations. Deep, what do you have that we should see or think about?
Right. So I recently saw Sojourners and two plays, Sojourners and Her Portmanteau, both written by a Nigerian-American playwright, Mofuniso Udofia. It's currently playing at New York Theater Workshop. And it's about a Nigerian immigrant family. And it's two plays in what's going to become a 9-play cycle.
So I guess she's written about 4 of them, but this is 2 out of them, right?
Yes. Yeah. One other one's been produced, and it's just so exciting because it's a very different history of immigration that it's different from anything I've ever seen on stage. The only thing I can compare it to is Familiar by Denai Guerrera, but that family was Zimbabwean and they were very affluent, and this was like years, like, you know, 20, 30 years into them living here. But Sojourners is like about like when this young couple from Nigeria first land in Houston and how
Houston.
They make
I was
the life
ask which,
together.
Which city? Yeah. Okay. Wow. Yeah.
And how they deal with just being isolated and alone. And yeah. So it's so exciting to find a fresh new voice. You know, that it's sometimes you think, how many plays can I really go see before I become cynical and don't want to do this anymore, but like this was just like a much needed dose of energy for me.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. We have a wonderful Q&A with her we ran recently that Stuart Miller did, and it was fascinating to hear about. And it's fascinating. She's intending to be a 9-play cycle.
Yeah, I mean one more and she'll be August Wilson. So
right, exactly.
It's like might as well, but
Sojourners was originally produced at Playwrights Realm. Playwrights Realm,
right? Yeah. And they're associate producing this version,
right,
too.
Right.
And Ed Iskandar is directing it, who was on our podcast
That's right.
A few months ago.
Talking about Taming of the Shrew,
he
right?
He was talking about Taming of the Shrew.
That's fascinating. These are plays that some of them or all of them might make it to your local theater at some point.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Well, one of those plays several of them have been produced abroad.
Elsewhere.
Abroad. Produced regionally.
Outside of New York. In another country outside of New York.
Everywhere outside of New York is outside of the country.
Is foreign to us, right?
Yeah. But actually, fun fact, New York Theater Workshop has a Spotify account, and they made a playlist of the music featured in Sojourners and Her Portmanteau, because most of it was period.
Oh, okay.
Of that period. So there's Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, so American music of the period.
American.
I guess it's Fela Kuti. It's of the period in Houston.
Exactly. So it's a really good playlist. More theaters should have a Spotify playlist for their shows if they have some really good music.
That's a great idea. That's great. I tell you, not to get sidetracked, I always kind of enjoy whoever puts together the pre-show playlist.
Yeah.
Like I've always, in the few times I've worked on plays or done award shows, I spend an inordinate amount of time making sure that the pre-show playlist is awesome.
Right. Well, I mean, my favorite pre-show playlist was the one for
Straight White Man. Yeah, that was like
go down history.
Practically part of the, that was part of the production.
That was.
Yeah,
and
I can't wait to see what they're going to do on Broadway.
Yeah, they should make a pre-show playlist, Spotify playlist for straight white men on Broadway.
Knowing Young Jean, she's going to crowdsource what should be on it. And Facebook, if you follow her on Facebook, she's always crowdsourced. At least she's crowdsourced casting the parts.
Yeah.
Anyway, I will recommend a piece I belatedly came upon in Slate by Jordana Williams. She's a producer and director with Gideon Productions. And she wrote a hilarious piece on Slate about her quixotic attempt, actually not an attempt, her quixotic production of Company at her junior high in upstate New York. Junior high.
I remember that.
Yeah,
that was so funny.
It was from last November. The title is Have I Got a Play for You? And it's got a
Didn't she try to change it too? Is that?
Well, she had to because it's like, you know, Company's got pot smoking and it's got, it's got some adult material. It's got some swearing. And some like references to sexual positions. Anyway, she reproduced some of her like her Baudelaireized child-friendly lyrics. And I guess since I know Jordana and it sort of was, I was reading along. the funniest part was that not just the rewrites, but the fact that it's a school play and there has to be parts for like 60 people, and they just added all these supernumeraries and like apparently. People who weren't even, Amy, who gets married in the play, has children from a previous marriage. Like, there were young versions of the characters. There were children. There was a DeBarge song interpolated into it. I literally laughed out loud. And apparently there's interest from an unnamed producer in making this into some kind of a film or producing this as a story. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but in any case, I haven't revealed who it is.
It would make such a fun indie film.
Yeah, I think that would
like
make
camp.
That would make a fun film. Yeah, exactly.
Just like camp.
It's funny. A friend of mine is making a movie that's sort of similar about a children's theater production. Anyway,
inappropriate children's theater.
No,
production?
It's not inappropriate. It's a slightly different premise. I don't know if I could talk about it, but anyway, that it seems to be something people are doing films about.
We need to tell Howard Sherman he's on the young people doing inappropriate shows.
That's true. Anyway, the pictures are priceless because I know how young junior high is, but when you see you junior high kids going, they're doing Company and they like look like not much older than my son is in second grade. That would be funny to see. Anyway, that's my recommendation. And hopefully I'll have some plays to talk about next time. This is another wonderful episode. Deep, what do we say at the end?
Rate us on iTunes, review us. It helps people find us. We're on Stitcher, Google Play, and the things that we talked about will be on the show page.
All right. See you on the internet.